Accession number 15110, Reel 1.
Mr. Thomas, Reel 1. Where were you born, please?
Havardas, sir.
Which year was this?
8th of July, 1916. Oh, I beg your pardon, I was born in Cardiff, and I moved to Havardas when I was a week old, my mother having died. And I was brought up in Havardas, so I always look at myself as a Haverfordian.
Did you go to school in Haverfordas?
Oh, yes, yes.
How old were you when you left school?
16.
What had your father done for a living?
He was a butcher.
And so you left school in the early 30s?
Yes, I left school in 1932 and went out to Kenya in 1932 in December.
Why did you decide to do that?
Well, it was an adept of depression in this country, as you well know. There wasn't much work, there were no prospects. My father, having already gone to Kenya and was managing a farm butchery out there, and I went out to join him in December 1932.
So how did you come to be in the Navy?
I'd always wanted to join the Navy. As a matter of fact, I'd sat the Naval Apprentices examination at school, much to the disgust of our headmaster, who was a classical-oriented school, and I was destined for the church. But I sat the Naval Artificer Apprentice entrance examination, and on passing, I was informed by letter to report to Chatham, to St. Mary's Island, Chatham, the apprentice's school. And when I got home, the letter had been opened, of course, as parents did in those days. And I was informed that in no circumstances would I be able to join the Navy as long as she was alive, and promptly threw it in the fire. So shortly afterwards, I took off for Kenya in 1932. And I was out there 3 years working. Came home in December 1935 and joined the Navy in 1936.
Was it easy to get in?
Pardon?
Was it easy to get into the Navy?
No, it wasn't. I had a 3 months waiting time. First of all, because of my name. I have something in common with Geoffrey Swales. He suffered from a wartime name, as lots of people in those days, even named after General Joffre. I got a French name of Montauban. My name is George Daniel Montauban Thomas. And that raised a question in the recruiting staff. Had I any French connections? And of course, my references had to be taken up in Kenya, which was another delay. So when they were satisfied to my antecedents and my references, I joined the Navy in July 1936.
Why do you have a French Christian name?
People did in those days. They were named after Kitchener, Cronje, all sorts of war heroes of various wars. It is a common practice in this part of the world.
Was Montauban
a town in French, yes, which my mother, who died just after I was born, unfortunately, she wanted to be called Danny, and they incorporated this name, which she had taken a fancy to, because my father had some connection with it. He was in France at the time that I was born, you see. I was born in the First Battle of the Somme. And he was decorated in the First World War. He won the military medal during the First World War.
Where did you do your naval basic training?
In Devonport. You see, when I joined the Stoker Second Class, and most of South Walians, Irish and West Countrymen, joined Devonport Division. The Navy then was three separate divisions. And there the three meet, except on football fields and various places, and regattas. And I have Devonport Division, which I stayed with all my service. If it had been Portsmouth or Chatham, it would have been the same.
What did you think of the basic training that you got?
It was hard. There were 32 of us in our class, and we were informed that if we joined the Navy to see the world, first you've got to scrub it, then you've got to polish it. That was the attitude. It was hard work, hard graft. And then we started the technical training, which was a piece of cake for me because in those days I had a very retentive memory. And sit in the weekly tests or examinations, I wrote out the answers verbatim because I could memorize all the literature on it, all the lecture. You wrote all the lectures down, and the act of writing them down enabled me to memorize them. So it was quite easily I passed out with 100% because they couldn't mark me any less because I was writing the answers verbatim. So anyway, I must have been earmarked for something. And I went to two destroyers, then one after the other, based in Devonport in the local flotilla and on Irish patrols. First it was HMS Keppel, and then the ship's company turned over to HMS Broke, which is the old-fashioned destroyer Leaders. She was a four-boiler ship compared to the old VNWs, which she was a Leader. And we had no bathrooms. And doing boiler cleaning or bilges and things like that, which we did. It was a kettle on the galley with the cook's permission for hot water and half a bucket of hot water and washed on the iron deck.
What was the name of the ship?
Keppel was the first and Broke was the second. She was the last ship built in Pembroke Dockyard and towed around the Devonport for Keppel and Broke. And I left her then. I made first class stoker. It was unusual for a young stoker to go to a destroyer in those days. And I say there must have been something in my passing out that they sent me there, and I made first class stoker after a required 12 months service. And then I joined HMS Neptune on the South Atlantic station based in Simonstown, where I was there for just over a year, and was sent home then for accelerated advancement with the promotion, with the earmark for promotion to Métis, under the Métis scheme.
What was that?
That was the Fisher scheme, promotion from the lower deck, the mate scheme, which was extended at one time to include E engineers. It was the Jackie Fisher scheme, Admiral Fisher scheme, for promotion.
Promotion to what?
Officer.
From
the promotion from the lower deck, yes. And I came home and went to Devonport and did the there was an interruption, the Czech crisis, where we had a general mobilization in 1938, and eventually started the course, and I passed out as a mechanician candidate for mechanician, and was made Stoker Petty Officer, acting Stoker Petty Officer, mechanician candidate, before I'd finished 3 years' service. So I was what is known as a no-badge petty officer. It's a petty officer without a good conduct badge, which is very, very unusual. And I was mature looks anyway, age and looks for my service. I was losing my hair at that time. So I passed it off in the pub where the question was, what happened to your badge then? They lost it playing darts. But eventually I joined Rodney then as a petty officer, and that was in April 1939. And did my time then. First of all, the young petty officers used to get a stint in the picket boats, which carried petty officers then in the engine room, or acting petty officers in the engine room. And then started my watchkeeping duties. The object was to gain my watchkeeping certificate, which I gained and was confirmed petty officer in 1940.
What was HMS Rodney like to live and work in?
Age colours the picture a bit. But my recollection for Rodney, all the time I was in her, and I was in her covering a period of 7 years, was a very good one. She was a very good ship. She'd never paid off. So there's no last commission and this commission. She used to pay off a percentage, about a fifth every year, or every cruise. And they'd be made up then. But she never paid off. So there's never a completely new commission or last commission. Because the saying on board a ship usually is, last commission, all the best. But Rodney was never out of commission, and she never had a major refit. From the time she was built, from the time she was scrapped, 1927 to 1948.
Could you be comfortable aboard?
Oh yes, the messing was very good. The ventilation was a bit primitive. It was the old Punkalova system. There were no and there were portals in our messes because we were on the main deck. But hammocks, of course. When I was on the petty officer's mess, Stoke Petty Officer's mess, there was, I think, 24 or so in the mess. Yes, quite comfortable.
And the food?
The food was good. It was always good. Although monotonous and all we had our own bakery, you see, so we could always bake bread. And the galley staff were good, the cooks were good. As I say, the attitude on board the ship was always good. It was always a happy ship. And when I went back to her as a mechanician, I moved this one mess into the mechanicians and chief stokers mess. There were only 14 of us there. And as I say, we made ourselves comfortable. And most of our work, of course, was in the early part as a young petty officer. I was watchkeeping all the time. And in 1940, I was selected as a member of a prize crew, a boarding party, to join a destroyer. At that time, in April 1940, as you know, we were intended to lay three minefields in Norwegian territorial waters to force the iron ore carriers out into international waters where they could be intercepted. And I was sent to HMS Afridi, tribal class destroyer, under Captain Vian at the time. He was in Afridi. And as a boarding party to board these merchant vessels when we intercepted them, it was a usual thing, just take a toothbrush and a pair of socks, and that's it. And anyway, we had expected to be for a couple of weeks. And in the meantime, we were exercised on board under Captain Vian, who insisted that we'd board the whaler and row ourselves over and board the ship. And exercising in the North Sea in very bad weather, climbing nets into the whaler was a bit hair-raising, especially as we were armed. I had a service revolver with ammunition, and the rest of them did as well. The young stokers climbing up in front of you with a loaded revolver in the holster weren't very, very happy. None of us were trained in the small arms as such, in sidearms. We were training rifle shooting, of course. I was a good shot, having served for 3 years in the Kenya Defence Force when I was in Kenya, so I knew how to handle weapons, how to handle guns. But some of the party did not. And anyway, during this exercise, the Germans invaded Norway, and the whole situation changed then. The German fleet was at sea, and we were then, they landed the Royal Marines from Sheffield and Glasgow, I think it was, into Namsos, and we followed on then in with the Chasseurs Alpine and British troops on board the Polish troopship Stroby, and we went in at night, offload at night, went to sea again in the daytime. I was part of the boarding party, having no duties on board. We were left to act as an unloading party to disembark troops and equipment. looking back at reading the book which I just mentioned, they didn't have the equipment with them anyway. The Chasseurs Alpine didn't have their skis, so they couldn't operate properly. It was a fiasco from beginning to end, but it was very hairy because we were left there with just no equipment at all, no cold weather gear, no Arctic gear at all. Very cold, very miserable, and I must say, on times, very scared, because it is a picturesque little place in those days, Namsos was. The inhabitants had all gone up into the hills, so it was virtually deserted. And so we landed on the wooden jetties there. And we felt very vulnerable with the Germans in the hills all around us and the bombers bombing us with all the service revolver with six rounds of ammunition. But anyway, I was on the boarding party then. We were detailed then to escort 35 German prisoners back to Shetland. They were taken off a Norwegian destroyer, an old four-funneled destroyer. And we escorted them back on board a French destroyer, the Bison.
How long were you ashore at Namsos?
About 3 days, 3 nights. Till they got all the troops ashore, and then we picked up these to escort these prisoners on board a French destroyer.
What exactly did you do ashore there?
Nothing ashore at all, just offloading the these troop transports, and so the ships went to sea in the daytime and came back at night to offload, and this was spread over about 3 days, and they say we took the German prisoners back to Shetlands in the French destroyer, and they put us ashore then as no longer required as a prize crew. So I made my way back on board Rodney then.
So this French destroyer was called Bison?
Yes. As a matter of fact, Freddy and Bison took part in the evacuation of Namsos a few weeks, 2 weeks later, and they were both sunk by German dive bombers.
What impression did the German POWs make on you?
Well, they were a mixture of civilians and service people, and the crossing from Norway to Shetland, they were kept on deck. Never took them below at all. They were called invisible because it was a rough crossing anyway, and I was fortunate not to be on guard duty on deck with them, as I made myself comfortable in the petty officer's mess on board the French destroyer and went down below in the engine room, to just out of curiosity anyway. She was a beautiful ship, a brand new destroyer from the French Navy.
Was their attitude intimidated or arrogant?
They were very, very intimidated. I don't think they knew exactly what was happening to them, and of course they might have been very uncomfortable on an open deck in a destroyer crossing an old sea. They were cold and wet and miserable, I know that. And our escort weren't much better. We weren't much better either, those that were on deck looking after them. Although they couldn't go far, anyway.
Were they fed?
Can't remember them being fed at all. It was very difficult for us to be fed anyway, because French destroyers, in common with all destroyers, don't do a heck of a lot of cooking and all in rough weather. And if I remember, breakfast was hard-boiled eggs and spinach. And in one side, we created a bit of a confusion in the mess when we asked for water in the washroom, in the bathroom. And said, "You wash at sea?" So anyway, we got over that. And eventually go back to Shetland and made our way back on board Rodney then, who, as I mentioned before, in the meantime was covering the evacuation farther north. And she was hit by a 1,000-pound bomb, which came down through the weather deck and broke itself up on the main deck armour in the ordnance workshop.
Where was this?
Covering the evacuation from northern Norway, from Narvik. And Aldersness. She was dive bombed. We were all dive bombed anyway, continuously, really, because we had no air cover. We lost Glorious, you see. And she had the RAF planes, which had came off the ice where they landed on Northern Norway. They had an airfield on the ice at one time. But we had no air cover at all. And of course, Glorious met up with Sharnos and Nidar. And they were lost. They had no aircraft to provide cover or anything at all. So they just landed on the RAF Spitfire. No way could they take off. And they were all lost anyway.
What happened to you next after the Bison?
I rejoined Rodney then. And we landed in Shetlands and joined the RAF depot ship in Solombow, if I remember correctly. I'm a bit hazy on this. And anyway, we made our way back to Scapa Flow and I rejoined Rodney.
For what kind of duties?
We were on North Sea patrol, covering the actions in Norway and relieving, or covering the evacuation from Norway. Remember the Guards Regiment and the Sherwood Foresters, various other people coming back.
What condition were they in?
The Guards had all their arms. Some of the other regiments didn't. But they had no personal contact with them at all. They were just faces, really. Had no conversation with anybody. You see, in a big ship like Rodney, it was up to 2,000 personnel. Souls on board. You can be very isolated in your own department. Where in very cold weather, of course, it was sometimes months on end before we went up on deck. Because in northern waters, it was only the seamen and people I got on deck had protective clothing. And even when I had the maintenance of the catapult, I was working on the catapult with no protective clothing at all. And in darkness, which it was mostly up there in northern waters, we had a blue torch, nothing brighter than a blue torch. And just what clothes you could put on yourself to keep yourself warm. You weren't provided with any special clothing at all. Because the only person that I know in the engine room department in Rodney who had winter clothing was the upper deck chief stoker, who manned the capstan. He had a duffel coat of sea boats. That was the only concession to weather and the only concession to the engine room department. It was very, very departmentalised in that respect. The engineer will always sit below the salt in the Navy. Not only in the Navy, but in other business as well. I told my director when I was working for Unigate that the engineer will always sit below the salt at his table. And I had a battle for many years to upgrade the status of engineers in the industry. I was an engineer with the United Dairies when I left the Royal Navy in 1958 until I retired in 1980.
So you had rejoined the Rodney for these kind of duties.
Yeah.
What do you remember happening next?
Incident, this is anecdotal, of course, was that I committed a cardinal sin in the service. I volunteered. When Italy came into the war on the side of Germany, having served in Kenya and fluent in Swahili, I thought that I would be more beneficial to the country by serving in East Africa. So when I was paraded in front of the engineer commander, he informed me in no uncertain terms that I would be of more benefit to the Royal Navy and to the country by qualifying as a mechanician. So I left for Chatham and joined the mechanician's course in St Mary's Island in Chatham, in Chatham Barracks, where the course had been moved from Devonport, where its home was, to Chatham to allow the artificer apprentices to take over our premises in Devonport away from the Battle of Britain, which was at his height at that time. And for the months we were at Chatham, on course, we spent most of our time in shelters in the dockyard during the daytime, and at night time in the tunnels under the barracks in Chatham. And there were a few hair-raising occasions in Chatham. If you were taking a shortcut across the lines in Chatham back to barracks, you were more danger from being impaled on a bayonet of a young sailor than you were from the Germans, because they had checkpoints all over the place in Kent at that time, anxious about German invaders, paratroopers. So flocks of young seamen careering around the countryside with Buford's guns on lorries and manning checkpoints. And if you were coming over in the dark, you heard the word halt with a bayonet about an inch into your chest at the same time. So,
were there any accidents?
Not that I know of. There were lots of stories, but I wouldn't care to quote them as fact anyway. But that did happen to me a couple of times, coming over, returning to barracks, with a young sentry there with a bayonet stuck in his chest before he got the word halt out. And so we moved then.
Was there any bombing of Chatham at that time?
Oh, yes. There was there were dogfights. We were watching dogfights when we could. And I have an uncle who was a retired lieutenant shipwright living in Borden, outside Sittingbourne, which I used to get out a couple of weekends to him. And then I was free to watch, and you could see the aerial dogfights and all over Kent, with Spitfires and Hurricanes and the Germans coming in. So a few of them shot down.
But did bombs land in Chatham?
I can't remember them landing in the barracks when I was there at all, no. But when we moved to Devonport, they did.
Was this after Chatham?
After Chatham, yes. In the October 1940, we moved back to Devonport. They had built an apprentices' school in Torpoint. Artificial apprentices' school in Torpoint. So they moved over from the mechanician training establishment over to their school in Torpoint, HMS Fiskard. And we took over our own premises in Devonport. And at that time, the Germans decided to bomb Plymouth. They hit our mess, one part of the barracks. They hit our block, Chief and Petty Officer's block, and got out of that one. And there was so much damage there that a lot of us got digs ashore. And I had digs in Barton Avenue in Stoke. And the next week we were hit there. My op and myself managed to escape with just minor injuries. And unfortunately our landlord and landlady were both killed.
Where were you at the time when the bomb fell?
In the house, in the basement, downstairs.
You were sheltering?
Oh, yeah. And as we all were, all in the house. Yeah.
What was the first thing that you heard?
Starting an explosion, darkness. There was so much dust, it's unbelievable. I had a brand new doeskin suit, which I had made up in Greenock in 1940. And when I salvaged it from the ruins, it was white with a fine, very fine plaster dust, the old-fashioned houses, Latin plaster walls. When the bomb hit, there was a cloud of dust smoke.